T.S. Eliot. Four quartets. I can't read it. We shall not cease from exploration, and the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and to know that place for the first time. Good old T.S. Eliot. Where did I first start? I used to do a lot of rock climbing. I've told you this before, most of you. And I was very intellectual young man. I taught maths in college, and as many young people are, thought a lot and worried a lot and anxious and everything, and I started rock climbing. And I found an amazing thing that when I put myself in a situation where I had to concentrate completely on what I was doing, otherwise I'd fall off and injure myself. After doing that for an hour or so, when I got to the end, to the top, not because it was the top, because it was the end, I'd feel so peaceful and fulfilled and whole. It was wonderful. A very rare occurrence in my life. So I used to do it a lot. And it pretty well always happened. Not always, but pretty well always happened. And then, quite completely by chance, completely unrelated, I went to Japan. I went to Japan for a 6-month contract as an engineer. Stumbled upon this little old man called Nishijima. Found that he was talking about some kind of state that you could get when your body and mind were balanced. And something, not consciously, but almost unconsciously, clicked. And I became involved with him and with the Shobo Genzo and the whole project. And all those books, reading them all, studying them all. All that stuff, all that knowledge. And now 40 years later, I'm back at the same place. It's the same place that my teacher arrived at when he was in his 90s. He didn't express it in the same way as me. He said, the whole of Buddhism is balance of the autonomic nervous system. This doesn't sound very Buddhist. But he thought that one way to explain, especially to Westerners, this particular state was to explain it in terms of physiology. When the two sides of our nervous system, the parasympathetic and sympathetic subsystems, one which makes you anxious, alert, aggressive, and the other which makes you passive and relaxed and so on, when they're in balance, not too active, not too passive, then you feel in the state which Nishijima Roshi said at the end of his life was the aim of Buddhism for him, and it is for me too. So, you know, what's with all that? Do we have to take the journey? I suppose yes we do. So I wouldn't like to stop anybody reading all those books. And I urge you, Eliana, to read every one.
I will report yes. In 20 years' time.
Yes, yes. Ouija board will be okay. We'll probably get through. won't be there waiting.
You never know, Mike. You never know.
No, I never know. No. That's quite
important.
You might
have to work the other way around, you know.
Oh, yes. Have you read them all yet? But how can it be that there's all that volume of study, literature, writing, saying, thinking, but all it is that simple state I got at the top of a climb? Can it really be that? Can it? I can't answer that for you. I can answer it for me. But if we come back to the meaning of the word Buddha, awakened, and look at what awakened means, to me it means the simple meaning, not something spiritual, not awakened to some kind of special state, but just awake to the present. All Dogen's writings are about this, to be in the present. We are in the present, aren't we? Well, yes, we are. We can never escape from it. But we've, for some reason, human beings have developed a special way of escaping from an inescapable present. And the way we did it was to divide ourselves so that we got a place in which we can imagine things that aren't here. Either imagine things that were and not no longer, or things that aren't yet. And with that imagining, we've been able to create a wonderful civilization, civilizations, many different kinds. Great, wonderful. Look at that thing. But the other side of that is it's enabled us to be somewhere other than we are, in a certain area. And if you read all those books and read some of the sayings of the old Chinese masters, Japanese masters, and so on, you can see in, for instance, the Koan stories, which I'd like to talk about more tomorrow. Again and again, the masters are saying it's about being where you are, doing what you're doing, not being somewhere else. And they describe it in many, many ways. And of course, I can talk about it in many ways, and you can talk about it in your way. So you can see where all the books come from. It's all the different ways of saying it. To be whole, to be present, to be here and now, to be part of the universe, to occupy our place in the cosmos. And you can go on and on and on. And you could just write quite a thick book of those phrases. Well, that's a good idea. A thesaurus of presence. You could, couldn't you? But although you can write a big thick book about it, there's only one actual experience. And that actual experience only ever takes place now. It doesn't take place in our brains. A thought can take place now in our brains. We can have a thought in our brain now that we are here now. But that thought of being here now is not the same as being here now. What's so important about this? You know, sometimes we're here, sometimes we're watching a film or thinking about tomorrow. Isn't that human life? Well, yes, it's true. So what's the importance of it? Well, as civilization has developed, we've become more and more skilled at being somewhere else, and never more so than in the present world. Oh, sorry, it's a text coming in here. You know, and immediately I'm not here. Oh, did you talk to me? Sorry, I was just reading my phone. We're not here. And it's so pervasive now that we have whole generations of society who spend quite a lot of time somewhere else. I've just spent a month with my grandsons in Australia. Lovely little boys. They spend most of their lives very much in the here and now. But increasingly, they spend a lot of their lives on the game, PS4 game machine. And it grips them. They're living in it. They live in the game. Come and have your tea, Ewan. Oh, I can't. We're just on a critical part. No, stop it now. Oh, I can't stop it. We'll lose all we've got. And then tears. Little boy, you know, in tears because he has to come out of his game into the real world. So for me and for my teacher, that's what it's all about. Only that. But to realise that what it's all about, we may be on a journey, and it may be a long journey. But the Buddhist journey, if there is one, maybe we shouldn't say Buddhist, maybe we should say the human journey, if there is one, may arrive back where we started. Where else can we arrive? We start in the present. As babies, we start in the present. And we end up back in the present. But knowing it, there's a big difference. So I think it's very amusing, really, that we've produced all this literature and all these ideas and all these explanations about something that's so simple. But because we haven't understood it, it's had an amazing effect on our societies and on the way that we look at nature. If you only got to watch a few nature programs to see how we overlay human tendencies. Now the little squirrel has obviously decided he's got to keep some nuts for the winter. So he's looking around now, and then he'll remember where they are, and in the spring he'll go back and dig them up. Oh, you're like hell. It's not like that. Well, what is it like then? Well, one of the big things that happened when, in the distant past, somehow, I've no idea how, we learned to split ourselves, to develop our mental capacities so that we could imagine situations that weren't actually here. The start of our civilizations. We also started to form a model of ourselves which has been very powerful until quite recently when neuroscientists have begun to question it. The model is that our mind, our visualization, mental or whatever, is the controller. It's the intelligence. And then it sends signals out and our physical body then does it, you know. And things like computers computer controlled robots seem to support that. You've got a little CPU that's thinking, it's going through its program, and then it sends signals down the wires, and the little robot does something. But I'd like to suggest that that's not a true view. It's a model. It's a model that served us very well, but it's wrong. It's a lie. Intelligence doesn't exist in an abstract area controlling the concrete area. In fact, intelligence and embodiment are one. That's why a spider who doesn't sit and think, I think I'll put another bit from there to there, then a couple of bits across there, it'd be nice to have a bit circle, a bit in the middle. If a spider doesn't do that, it moves intelligently, as every living thing does. Only human beings try and imagine what the animal must be doing, thinking. And we think it about ourselves too. So I was brought up to believe that I had to think about things and then do them. I had to plan my life and then do it. Of course I do, it's true. If I don't plan to come to Lower Shore Farm on Thursday night, then I won't be here. But at the same time, we've lost the ability to trust a state of wholeness where we don't think about what we're doing, but what we're doing has its own intelligence. To be a spider or a squirrel, really, I suppose. And that's a huge loss to civilization. So instead of trusting our whole selves, we trust our abilities to think. But our ability to think is fallible, very fallible, as you must know if you look carefully at your own life. And mine are, very. My thoughts, actually, if I'm honest, my thoughts rarely agree with my actions. I kind of massage it to make it look like it. I was going to do that anyway, yes. I didn't really want to do that. But in truth, my thoughts very rarely agree in any meaningful way with what I do. So what do I do then? Well, something's guiding me. Well, we could call it God. We could call it spirit, call it the universe. Doesn't matter what we call it, really. But we could say, without being spiritual, that there is an intelligence in life itself. And that intelligence, just using the word intelligence separates it out, but it's part of life. So life itself has direction. Our life itself has its own direction. And we can, if we wish, just follow the direction we're going in. As if walking in the snow, we can, if we want to know where we're going, we can, seem to be going that way. Okay, I'll carry on. Could live like that, couldn't we? But very few people do. Some people do. Probably unknown to others. Maybe we do to a much larger extent than we think. If you look at the recent findings of neuroscience, they're increasingly revealing that the way we actually live, the way we operate, the way we think and act are very different to the model that we've lived with for thousands of years, which is the mind, little wires, and the body. Now, to me, that's all Buddhism is about. That's all it's about. And that's what my teacher was saying. So how to be in the present? Or how to stop not being in the present? Maybe it's better. Well, you could stop everything that takes us out of the present. No phones, no books, no nothing. No talking to other people about things, because that might take us out of the present. We're just sitting. Oh, wait a minute, that's what we were just doing, though, wasn't it? Well, that's one way, isn't it, then? Just sit. Just sit and be where I am. But as we all know, it's quite difficult, because the habitual mental activity, well, it doesn't stop. It's got inertia. There's all these things coming and going. But in a way, it's a wonderful thing that we do to practice sitting where we are already. And if we practice sitting where we are already, we learn to recognize that wholeness, that unseparated state, where our thoughts are not directing our body, but we're living just as we are, going just where we're going, being just where we are. So that's why Zazen has become so important, or whatever you call it, meditation. And that's why sports activities, all those kind of things, are becoming more important in the modern world, because they have a similar effect in a way. I don't play tennis, but I always like to use the tennis analogy, because I watched the Australian Open while I was in Melbourne with my daughter, and you see these incredible athletes on the line, jogging backwards and forwards. And it's so obvious that what they're trying to do is be exactly where they are at the moment they're there, to forget the point they just lost, not to think about the point they want to get, but just to be there. So they jog about backwards and forwards. And anybody who's done any kind of physical activity can recognize that aspect. So in that sense, what I'm talking about doesn't belong to Buddhism. It could equally belong to some other religion, as long as it's talking about the same value of experience here and now. So it makes me wonder whether we're in a post-Buddhist era, moving into a post-Buddhist era, a post-Christian era, a post-Muslim era. I would very much like it to be true. I've no idea whether it is. So when I see Buddhists all studying all this Buddhist stuff, makes me want to say, come on, get on with the journey. But our life is our journey, so the books are the journey, the study is the journey, whatever we do, whatever it is. But we may end up, as T.S. Eliot says so eloquently, back where we started, and recognise where we are. There are quite a few teachers on the internet. I don't know if you look at YouTube, there's lots and lots of people who's spiritual teachers, they call themselves. And they're all, watch one or two of them, but they're all saying the same thing. They're all saying what I'm saying, but they're not Buddhists. I don't mean to say that Buddhism has no value. It's, in a way, carried the torch of something that this man discovered whenever it was. Does anybody remember the date of the Buddha's birth? 400 BC, was it?
It's contested.
Oh, right, okay. The contested date. He discovered something. He sat under a tree and he realised, I'm here. He'd always been here, but to realise you're here and the value of being here is very different. And that realisation has been carried by this strange religion or practice in many different ways down through the ages. But that maybe other people realised it. No idea. Dogen writes in one of his essays in the Shobogenzo, you don't, if you're a Buddha, you don't need to recognise you're a Buddha. We as human beings, we have a tendency not only to want to do good or to be good or whatever, but to know that we're doing good or being good. We desperately want to know, am I okay? Is what I'm doing okay? But Dogen says you don't need to know, but it's true. So you don't need to try and recognise whether you're in the present or not, just be in the present. You don't actually need to tell anybody else, I'm in the present, I'm in the present. Just be in the present. There must be millions of people who, quite unknown to the rest of the world, are living in the present. They've got written no books, they don't belong to any groups, but they're living in the present. No idea where they are. But they're all Buddhas. But unfortunately for us, we have to keep practicing being in the present, sitting again where I am. And trying desperately not to get distracted by all the rubbish that Shinri Suzuki says, it's like going to the toilet, all the rubbish that emerges. Mm-hmm. Like taking the lid off a boiling pot, all the stuff boils up. So not to be distracted by that, but to say to ourselves, I'm sitting in the present, I'm sitting in the present, and then to try and forget that we're sitting in the present. To know the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be enlightened by the myriad dharmas. All these things sound so complicated and spiritual. But if we are present and forget that we're present, we are one with everything else. We are in our place, absolutely ourselves, yet connected with everything else. We don't know. We don't need to know it. And that's a lot of the theme in Genjo Koan. Birds in the air, fish in the water. What he's trying to say, just to be in our place. But of course, as Václav Havel says so eloquently, words can't catch what we want to say. Even for Dogen, the words don't catch what he wanted to say. So we just keep on and on and on trying, and it ends up like that. Oh dear. Yes, but you'll never get your work done just sitting there. It's true. We have to contribute to the wonderful society that separation between body and mind has created. And that's a whole different story. We've got to fit into the system, the big system, created so that we work at the bottom and channel all the rewards up to the top. Get frustrated, get disappointed, unrewarded, work too hard. So you really need to just sit now and again. So it's to get rid of all those layers of stuff that we habitually carry around with us. There's something quite nice underneath, isn't there? I'm not quite sure what it is. But in Buddhism they call it our original face. Or the face we had before our mother and father were born. And all kinds of weird expressions. So getting rid of all the layers that we put on top of me may be the most important work we can do.
Where the problems start when you try and hang on to that state, though. something, oh, and something usually kicks in around about this time on a retreat. We've been sitting for a day, and I'm like, oh yeah, actually, life's quite interesting, actually, isn't it? It's quite, you know, it's all right being alive. But then it seems all this big sort of edifice, you know, talk about it, seems to be about trying to cling on to that in some way, trying to make that manifest throughout your life.
Yeah.
And it's not going to, you know, it comes to.
Well, that's
Wednesday, I'm going to be sort of, you know,
that's the result of the fact that we recognise our nice state, and then immediately we recognise it, we create an image of it, and it's the image we want to hang on to. But we can't. So we have to find that state again, or be in that state again, every moment. So it's not, oh, I've taken all the stuff, all the rubbish off the top of me, and I feel very happy, and now I'll be like that forever. As anybody knows, it can disappear. Well, it does, doesn't it? You go on retreat, and after 3 days of sitting, you can feel really whole till you go home. Oh, and it all disappears again. Well, you start again then.
Like, what is the benefit of this state?
Benefit?
Yeah.
I don't know.
To you, it's medicine for anxiety. To me, it's also the same. Yeah, feel less anxious after I sit, and you know, makes me more productive. You know, my mental clarity increases. But is that just as simple as medicine for anxiety? You know, Buddha out of compassion, you know, helped us how to overcome suffering. Why don't we call ourselves support group for people with anxiety? Why do we talk about wholeness or something else?
You'll feel free to set up a group. There's no reason.
Is it all I get if I forget where my nuts are and now they're rotting in the ground?
You know what?
This is all I get if I become more like a squirrel and forget where my nuts are and they're rotting in the ground.
No, you get a certificate.
All I get is just less.
But you get a certificate.
No,
Lev became the squirrel today. Signed.
Well, like it has just become less anxious, right?
There's no value to it. No. You don't get anything from it.
You say it's important.
Well, yes, it's important. But if you say why, I cannot answer. But is it important? Yes or no? Is it important to feel whole? We can make a judgment on that purely from our experience. Yes, it is. Or no, it's not. No reason for that. It's not a thought out judgment, just simply, is that an important state? Yes or no? Is this an important state? Yes or no? End of story. There's nothing to get from it. It's not part of the structure of society. You're not on the way to somewhere. In fact, in a way, it's antisocial. Outside the social structure. Thank God. We need to have our feet outside the social structure, otherwise it'll drown us. The levels of stress in modern society are higher and higher and higher. Children right through to old people all have levels of stress so high that they got so used to them that they don't recognise it's stressed even. So So to have your feet outside, so you're living in a tent, which is society, right? Civilization. But you have your feet outside through the tent door onto the ground like that. Important. No reason, it's just important. Try it. Is it important? Yes or no?
I've heard an interesting explanation of why it feels important to meditate, to seek, to practice stillness. From evolutionary point of view, apparently we are still wired in the same way as our ancestors who would have prolonged periods of time of doing absolutely nothing, just sitting, just be there, either waiting for the next prey to come by or just because they've already eaten and have no need to go out and hunt more. And this physiological need of allowing yourself to do nothing, to be still for a while, is very deeply wired in us, in our genes, in our makeup, and in what we are still now. And probably that's why it feels good to just sit, and probably that's why we do it again and again and again, even if the back hurts and knees are screaming and all that. But there is something which feels like not pleasurable, but just right thing to do. So maybe that's one of explanations why it is important. I don't know.
Certainly an explanation, yeah.
Yeah, I got it from the book, of course.
Yes. Yes, it's an explanation. There must be many different explanations.
Yeah.
But it's beyond explanation. When we experience something, we have a feeling about that experience.
Yeah.
It's not an intellectual judgment or a mental evaluation. And one way to live may be to follow that judgment rather than our socially conditioned judgment. If you read, Dogen wrote a chapter called Not Doing Wrong, Shōwaku Makusa, in the Shōbu Genzo, and it's about that. It's about following a different kind of judgment. In society, we are taught to believe that there is something called right, and we can make that right, we can create that right as an actual thing. So right exists somewhere. It's called ethics or morality. What Dogen says very strongly in that chapter is there is no such thing as right somewhere waiting for us to do it. Oh, what a terrible thing to say. Of course there is. Well, he says there's not. And the reason he says there's not is because he's talking from the viewpoint of direct evaluation of experience. That is, our experience itself tells us whether something is, I don't like to use the words, good or bad, right or wrong, valuable or not valuable. The experience itself contains it. So morality is integrated into action or into life, not separate from it. But we're not used to living like that. In fact, it's almost impossible to live like that. And that's what Dogen says we can do, and we could try. And my teacher used to say, just practice Zazen and don't worry about anything. Oh, it's okay for you to say that. But he meant it. He didn't mean, just practice, don't worry about anything. No, he meant, if you just practice, don't worry about anything. because if you discover who you are or root yourself outside the tent or whatever you like to say, then you are moral. Not moral in a social sense or in a religious sense, but in a real sense. That's what he says. So it's quite revolutionary. Morality is in what you do, or where you do, the place you do it from. So if you act from wholeness, that's it, don't worry. What? But it's true for me. It's a bit scary because we're educated to think about what you're doing. Is it going to be the right thing to do? What is the result going to be? Think about this, you know. Make a plan. Do a risk assessment.
But did the majority of us follow that plan, really? Did we not maybe just wing it?
Good point.
Did we all just wing it, really?
Yes. That's a very, very important point, that we live far closer to the way Dogen talks about life than we realise.
Let it be.
Good old George.
We're winging it, we've got to. As long as, I suppose, going back to what you said and we're speaking about, as long as there's some form of wholesome action to it, we're hoping for a result that if we're wanting kindness and everything else for a good result to be good for others or anybody about us. And I guess that's kind of like through the sin that we hope to channel it anyway. But in general, just wing it.
Winging it and don't worry about the result. Sounds terrible, doesn't it?
Or worrying about the result, but trying to learn to not worry about the result.
Yeah. Or not worrying that we worry about the result.
About worrying.
Yeah.
For me, society, the world, is full of people telling me what direction to be going in and what is right or what is wrong.
That's right, yes.
I mean, the various books that are decreeing how people should behave. Jacob Rees-Mogg came to mind just now when we were talking, and Anne Widdecombe. They are so convinced that they are correct in what people should do, and they will broadcast it and preach it and insist that they are correct. And,
well, it's because they're insecure.
Well, yeah. But I think when I started to sit, you become more sensitive to all these influences, and then needing to continue to sit, to sort of centre, to be able to withstand is the wrong word, because it sounds like you're sort of a... something standing up against the waves flowing, but being able to actually go with the waves and be free whilst living in the rough sea.
Mm.
And that's what sitting Zazen is about.
Like a seaweed.
Yeah. In amongst society and other people.
There's this movie about Thich Nhat Hanh and his monks called Walk With Me. There's a movie about Thich Nhat Hanh and his monks called Walk With Me.
Ah, yes.
And there's this amazing scene of this monk who, you know, gave the oath of being a monk, has no possessions, you know, celibate, living in Plum Village. He's about 30 years old, and he goes back to San Francisco to visit his parents. And he comes there, and his parents show him his old notebooks and diaries when he was 9 or 10. and he has this beautiful, you know, like comic of his plan for his life. Well, he's gonna, you know, be a straight A student, go to Harvard, you know, like get a girlfriend when he's 25, become a CEO, like get an MBA, just like amazing, have a salary of $100,000, like it's just amazing, like his life is all planned out there. And it says like when he's like 70, it says like achieve enlightenment. But you see him read this, you know, of his dreams and how he planned his life, and now he's living in Plum Village, has no possessions, like nothing. It's amazing, you just watch him contemplate it.
So basically he just cut corners and went straight to 70 to the final.
So were his parents suggesting he'd done it wrong? Because pushing this in front of him sort of implies to me, I mean, I haven't seen the film, but, you know, there's almost a judgment. Look what you plan to do, and look what you've ended up in. Bordeaux, and you've
done nothing.
You're saying he's immoral. Huh?
You're saying he's immoral.
Well, is that what his parents are saying?
Well, hang on, you haven't seen the film even.
No.
Don't forget it.
From what? Yeah.
I mean, the rest of the film is. You don't need to watch the rest of the film. Just people walking around.
Yeah. Been to PV.
there are great teachers around. Thich Nhat Hanh is a very great human being.
Mm-hmm.
I think. One thing I learned from my teacher was not to give up responsibility for myself to a teacher, if that makes sense. But I sometimes think that big charismatic teachers attract people who want to give their lives to the teacher. And I'm pretty sure that's not a good thing to do.
Thich wanted that, but I think that's what's built up around him.
Who?
Thai, Thich Nhat Hanh. It's referred to as Thai. Teacher.
Oh.
By his mates. One of his mates.
No, but it's difficult because I'm sure he may not want it, but I'm sure there are lots of people who want to.
Yeah, around him.
Around him.
Yeah. Sure.
And that creates a community that's based on a kind of strange hierarchy.
Mm-hmm.
And there are so many examples of that in the world.
Mm.
We want a saviour. Please save us. Tell us how to live. But didn't the Buddha say on his deathbed, be a light unto yourselves, or something similar to that? Well, to me that means, it's up to you, mate. There's a torch, find your own way.
It's what?
A torch.
Torch.
And it is up to us, isn't it? Tomorrow we can look at some examples of the Koan stories. I brought some copies of the book. It's rather nice because you can open the book anywhere and read one and then close it. So it's a theme through all the stories. Not all of them. Many of the stories, the theme is just what we've been talking about.
Mike, in Zen, does nature do the talking throughout history? Would you say, has nature always been the key element? Are we now, where we are today, so disconnected with nature in general, the majority of us, society? Is that the key, is that the main problem to things, if there is a problem?
Don't know. I don't know what Zen is either, really. The teaching, whatever you like to call it, came to Japan in an esoteric form, I think in the 6th century. It was very spiritual and esoteric. And then in the 9th century, I think, Indian monk called Bodhidharma was said to have come from India to China, showing people how to sit based on the practice of sitting. And Dogen says that all the schools that came from that, they call Zen schools, because Zen is half of the phrase Zazen. Za means sitting, Zen means meditation. So Zen, any school that's based on sitting. Nature. I don't know what nature is. Is that nature there? I suppose it is, because they're just as they are, aren't they? They're quite happy being exactly as they are, where they are. Drooping a bit.
Am I happy?
Oh, yes. Oh, I'll have to write a book about this. What are they? Yeah, this is...
These roses don't want to.
This is our frustration, language. The flowers are as they are. Flowers? Okay, the flowers and leaves are as they are. And so it goes. But I think in the early days, monks lived in nature, but so did most people. Some monks lived in isolation, temples up on the top of mountains, and I suppose must have been quite nice. But for me, I don't want to leave and go to a top of a mountain, so I have to find nature here. If nature means our natural state, I suppose nature is everywhere. You can say that stove is nature, I suppose. In modern Japan, there's a very big gap between society and nature. Although they'll incessantly write and talk about how harmonious they are with nature, in fact, I don't think Japanese society is, as a whole, is very at peace with nature. People have an image of Zen, which probably includes pictures of temples and incense and so on, peace and some kind of deep understanding of the sound that the bamboo makes. And but Japan's not like that at all. It's our overlaying it. We overlay our own spirituality onto Japan. It's not like that.
Even up in the mountains.
Pardon?
Even up in the mountains.
Oh yeah, well, you know, everything I say has got exceptions. No, up in the mountains there are hotels and ski resorts. And in the deep primordial forests of the slopes of Japanese mountains are hunters with shotguns hunting boars, which they will then sell to the supermarkets and go drinking.
But they're vegan.
No.
You're destroying our...
Yes, I'm purposely destroying it because because Japan's not like people think. I've met several young people who want to go and find enlightenment in Japan. And I tell them, you won't find it. But they usually go and then come back and say, oh, I didn't find it. So we have to do the journey, don't we?
Temples are pretty natural though, aren't they, to be fair? You go to Kyoto and have a look around, most of them are.
Oh yeah.
The souvenir shops.
Sorry?
With souvenir shops.
Yeah, okay. And the vending machines, I know, but still, I think.
Yeah, you take human beings out of it and everything's natural. Look at all the deserted villages around Fukushima, where the nuclear... beautiful. Vines creeping in through the windows, concrete covered by plants. Very natural and peaceful.
Just don't breathe in. Hold your breath.
It's the same as the area around Chernobyl, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's a beautiful place now.
Yeah, nature's very forgiving.
Yeah.
What is nature?
Pardon?
Radioactivity.
It's my imagination.
Radioactivity.
That's what I mean.
Yeah.